the same old lie. We knelt down to pray, watched the blood moon in the sky. Gilgamesh in the tomb, Horus in the womb, old names on new mouths like a warning and a joke. Who keeps the keys? Who keeps the bone? Everybody points, but nobody knows. End the day's radio. End the day's radio. Nephilim in the tail, clones in the tube, monsters in the headlines, he's searching Saturn's cube. Who wrote the script? Who set the stage? Every locked door has another cage. End of days radio. End of days radio. End of days radio. Breaking mine. If the crowd wants a prophet, I'll leave them a sign. No crown, no halo. No chain, no throne. Jesus in the doorway. And roll back home. End of days radio. End of days radio. End of days radio. End of days radio. We keep.
Welcome to End of Days Radio. I am your host, Daniel, broadcasting to you from that shimmering Emerald City right here in the heart of the Pacific Northwest. Hello, how are you? It is so good to see everybody. Today's date is actually July 5th in the year of our Lord, 2026. July 5th, yesterday was July 4th, and let me tell you, my ears are still ringing. The cat is still hiding, and I'm looking forward to tonight because I know all the crazy people around me still have fireworks left, still have hamburgers left, and they are still going to blow my ears out. So looking forward to that. But until we get there, today's guest is none other than the host of the Dancing Toaster podcast. His name is Pastor Nelly Van Sickle. A little description of his show. The Dancing Toaster is a weekly podcast hosted by Pastor Nelly that explores the intersection of faith, the paranormal, and the unexplained. The show blends theological reflection with deep dives into cryptids, hauntings, cults, and folklore. Let's go ahead and waste no time and bring on the man himself. Nelly, how are you?
I'm doing well, Daniel. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's good to see you. You look like you have one heck of a studio behind you. I'm seeing lots of books, lots of cool little figurines and things like that. Boy, how long did it take you to collect all that?
I'm a huge nerd. Most of the stuff you see behind me, my pastoral library and all the stuff up top there is Ghostbusters collectibles. Most of them are modern. I got rid of all the vintage stuff just because they don't hold up well. They don't age well. They mold really easy. So I got a lot of just modern Ghostbuster toys, and because I'm a man child and I enjoy it. But the Dancing Toaster, that name comes from Ghostbusters 2, or at least the reference is a Ghostbusters reference. So obviously that's my favorite movie of all time. So, it was only natural to have all my Ghostbuster stuff here in the office/studio with me.
So this, I imagine this goes back to the original Ghostbusters.
Good stuff. The first Ghostbuster movie, I've watched it an obscene amount of times, but even the sequel, I know it gets a lot of hate. I personally love the sequel as well, and I've watched it just as many times. I don't think I can watch one without watching the other. I didn't like the 2016, was it 2016? The attempt at a reboot was not my favorite, but the sequels with the kids and stuff I thought were a lot of fun, trying to get kind of reinvigorate another generation into watching Ghostbusters. If it means I keep getting Ghostbusters merch, I'm like, keep pumping out the movies, even if they're mid. I want to see more Ghostbusters stuff.
Sure. I mean, to me, Ghostbusters has some actual real life sort of occult stuff in it. If you pay attention to you know, what they're actually telling you, the stuff like ectoplasm, I've looked into it. Ectoplasm is a real thing that poltergeists can leave behind, and they've actually collected it.
Well, and Dan Aykroyd, he was obsessed with all that stuff, like IRL. So it's been a part of his family's legacy. From father to grandfather. So all the stuff that he incorporated was very personal to him, and stuff that he got from like his grandfather's diaries and things like that. He ventured into things I personally, as a Christian and a pastor, wouldn't have ventured into, necromancy type stuff and seances. And so they were really big on having seances up in Canada. But he was really big into all that stuff. So all the vocabulary and whatnot, fresh out of that world for sure.
Absolutely. And just to kind of start us off, just wanted to learn a little bit about your background, who you are. Were you raised Christian, and did you ever depart the faith?
I was not raised Christian. I was pretty deist growing up. I believed in a God. I guess you could say I was agnostic, but specifically more deist. I knew there was a God, but I saw him kind of as a clockmaker. Made the universe, made the planet, hung it up, and just sat back and watched. Went through a lot of things growing up, and was just really angry at God. You would ask me which one. Well, whichever one's the right one, I'm mad at him because things didn't go the way that I wanted them to go. And when I was 17, one of the most supernatural things that ever happened to me was kind of what started me on my journey to faith. I'd traveled a little bit globally with my father, and was exposed to Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam and whatnot. But when we had moved back to the States, I was 17. We were in Austin, Texas, and I was run over by a truck, and I didn't have a bump, a bruise, a scratch. Like, my bicycle was totally wrecked, and I had tire tracks on my white tee. So I knew something had happened, but it didn't hit me what had happened, were it not for all the people that were pulling over and running across the street. It was a busy day too. I was like, I had gotten out of school, and I was just riding my bike like I always had done. And a guy ran a stop sign and went right over me, and my bike was crushed. And everyone was like, lie down, we're going to call the paramedics. And I was like, no, how am I going to get home? Look at my bike. And they're like, no, lie down. People who get ran over need to lie down. And I was like, wait, what? So I did. I laid down, they took me to the hospital because they wanted to make sure I didn't have internal damage and that kind of stuff. And it was my grandmother who was one of the major Christian influences in my life. I think that's true of so many. Shout out to all the praying grandmas, right? But my grandmother, she was one of the first ones into the emergency room. And, she looked at me, I looked at her, and we just started bawling. And I said, look, I don't know much, but I know I need to know why your God spared me. Cause I should be dead. I should have been crushed under the weight of a Ford. So I need to know why he stopped that truck from killing me. So I started going to church with her like 3 days later. And man, this was over 20 years ago now, because I was 17. I'm 40 now. So I heard the gospel. They had begun a series in the book of Romans, and I spent a few weeks listening to the most systematic explanation of the gospel in all of the Bible. And I remember, this is how unchurched I was. I remember hanging out with my grandmother on a Saturday, you know, because I was planning on waking up and going to church with her Sunday morning. But I said, Grams, how do you know when it's your turn? And she goes, your turn for what, sweetheart? I go, well, at the end of service, the pastor's always calling people up. How do you know when it's your turn to go up? And she kind of chuckled at me, but then she realized, like, he's really asking. He doesn't understand what's going on here. And she goes, honey, that's an altar call. So anyone can go up if you feel the Lord is leading you, you know, to go up and give your life to the Lord. That's what he's doing, is he's offering an invitation. And I remember I didn't hear a word of the service that particular Sunday. I was like knee bouncing, just ready for him to end it, because I was ready to sign on the dotted line and give my life to the Lord, now that I understood kind of what that meant, and couldn't wait to do that, because I was grateful that I had been saved on the side of the road that day, and then realized he did a heck of a lot more to save me long ago. So that's how I became a Christian, and probably the most supernatural thing that's ever happened to me is not being crushed by a Ford.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it sounds like it hit you and it actually went over you, like it ran you over physically, but somehow maybe the parts of the truck touched the bike, or somehow you narrowly escaped not having crushed ribs and a crushed skull and things like that.
Yeah, all I know is the bike was devastated. I mean, it was crushed. It was irreparable. And I had tire tracks all over my white shirt across. I should not be here, plain and simple. I should not be here. But yeah, he was making a right turn, and he did, no offense to my West Coast peeps. I don't mean this Texas boy, don't want to offend nobody, but they call it a California stop where I'm from. He just went right through. I mean, he rolled, he was watching to the left and not looking to where I was coming from on the right, and just went right over me. Last thing I saw was the hood of his truck. So he had to go right over me to end up on the other side of me. And yeah, it was crazy. I wouldn't have believed it were it not for all of the men and women that were pulling over their vehicles from both sides of the highway and then running over to tell me what happened. And they're all calling 911 and whatnot. So that wasn't the beginning of my journey of faith. Probably my time in Saudi Arabia is where I got really curious about religion. But theology was just kind of a curiosity at that point. And over there, I was exposed to all kinds of other faiths. I was able to go to this academy over there where I was surrounded by Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and things like that. But then as I grew up in the West predominantly, but I had some Christian family members that were devout, but I mocked them. I made fun of them and I mocked them. I wanted nothing to do with Christianity. But while over there, you know, you just can't be in that part of the world and not begin to get curious about what makes all this spin. And so, yeah, I came back, and after the truck, that things got a little serious as it pertains to theology.
How did you end up in a place like Saudi Arabia?
It was my dad's work. That's what it was. Things were getting really tumultuous at home. My parents split when I was pretty young. And as things got worse and worse and worse stateside, I knew I had to get out of there. And he was living overseas at the time. And I said, is there any way that I can come live with you? And we had to do, it was a long process to get me over there. Cause for the longest time, you couldn't even go to Saudi Arabia unless you were, you had to be invited by the government, or you had to have immediate biological family there. And they had to prove that you were their immediate biological family. Or if you were like a Muslim on some religious pilgrimage or something like that. But I had my dad there, and my dad had to submit all this paperwork to prove, like, this is my biological son. He wants to come live with me. And, I did. I went over there on the pretense of a visit, full disclosure, and I decided I was going to stay and live with them. And so I did for a time, and it was incredible. I lived in Jeddah, out right on the Red Sea. So just to be in a place that has such history, and man, it was cool. I wish I could go back, but very doubtful. I've been pretty outspoken about a lot of religious topics, but Islam, I've done a massive 2-part. Documentary kind of on Islam. So I doubt I'd be as welcome as I was the first time, but, yeah.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you're not a big fan of Islam. based on what you just said. And
I love Muslim people, but Islam, the religion, you are absolutely correct. I am not a fan. The more I got exposed to it while I was over there. I lived in a Sharia law country. I know it's not nice. It's not a good thing to be under. And they're a lot more liberal now than they were when I was living there. I mean, we're talking get caught stealing, get your hands cut off. I mean, you get a drug charge, you could be beheaded. And they did these things in public. So Sharia law is no joke. And it is a Sharia kingdom. And the current king, I mean, his dad was no joke. It was still very much a theocracy for a while. And they've lightened up a lot. Like I remember just a few years ago, it was crazy to find out that they were allowed to drive. Women were allowed to begin to drive, which when I was there was unheard of. So they've changed a lot. But Sharia law and Islam, I'm not a fan. And the more I study the original source material, the less of a fan I become.
You know, I've had somebody that's active on social media and talking about spiritual topics and things like that. I've occasionally had a Muslim person kind of try to tell me a little bit about the Quran or the faith and really try to sell and convince me about it. But I've always kind of answered the same way, that I don't really like the way that and I'm not hating on the religion or anything, but I don't like the way that they treat women. That was a big starting point or a big turn off for me.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And that's ingrained in their theology. Again, when you study the Quran, when you study the Hadith, women are truly second class citizens under Sharia law. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And again, living in a Sharia kingdom, I remember. So they had police that upheld civil law, but then they had something in Saudi Arabia called the Matawa, which were religious police. And to see a woman for walking without a cousin or a brother or a husband, just out walking by herself, for the Matawa to come and, you know, they take their shoes off and they begin beating her with the bottom of their sandals, which is a huge disrespect and you know, the Middle Eastern culture, even ancient Near Eastern culture, that's just a high disrespect, right? And they're beating her with their sandals as they're throwing her in the back of this truck and taking her away. Scary stuff. They don't treat women very well, and they don't treat young women very well either. I don't know what words you want me to avoid and how controversial you want me to be, but Muhammad, the more Islam, whatever beauty can be found in Islam is quickly dried up from their founder, from their prophet Muhammad. He is a disaster. I mean, I did almost a 2-hour episode on him alone, just his history. And one of the most atrocious things, of course, is, you know, marrying someone around 7 and consummating the relationship around 9. That's just, wow. That's indefensible. In my opinion, I don't care what faith is claiming that is indefensible. And so, yeah, he's the biggest problem I have with it. And so those that are, whenever they say like Islamists or, you know, it's just a strange few. It's like, well, no, the closer you get to their prophet, the more they behave like him, the more accurate the faith is being represented. It's the ones that are further away from the prophet that are the more passive. And I met a lot of really kind Muslims. Like I said, I love Muslim people. I mean, no disrespect to Muslim people, but I have no respect for Muhammad because of just the awful things that this man did. So, and they esteem him as the greatest man to have ever lived. I have a problem with that. When you consummate a marriage with a 9-year-old, to say that you're the greatest human being that ever lived, that I can't back you up on that one. So sorry, thank you for coming to my TED talk.
No, I have to agree with you on pretty much all of that. To me, one of the reasons I don't particularly care for Islam is it feels like it's a religion kind of meant to destroy other religions. Like when Islam goes into a country, it takes over, smashes all the idols of anything that's already existing there. Like in Egypt, the Egyptian religion from ancient times obviously isn't in control there. It's all Islam. And we can't learn fully what's going on there because of that strict religious sort of mentality of the people that are living there now. And there's other reasons too. But a lot of the same things you touched on, the pedophilia, you know, let's call it what it is.
Thank you. I wasn't sure I didn't want to get you in trouble, but yeah, it is what it is.
It definitely, I mean, there was a crusade in the past for some reason.
Especially the first one. Yeah. I've covered that too at length. Like the first crusade, I'm thoroughly convinced was a defensive war. I mean, it was for they were fighting for civilization, specifically Christian civilization, because Islam, wherever it goes, it does dominate. And that's intentional. Like when you study his life, Muhammad's life, and how Islam came to be this major force in the world. I mean, when he was first in that part, when he was first in Mecca and stuff, and he low in numbers, he was very passive, very accepting. You can read very early verses of the Quran. It's organized like shortest to longest, or maybe I'm mixing that up, but the books are not in chronological order. They're organized according to length, and the earlier verses, he sounds so tolerant and let everyone believe what they want to believe, and that's fine. But as he grew in number, he got far less tolerant, and so when he goes back to Mecca and he has all the numbers, he smashes every idol, kicks everyone out, and says, "If you're not going to worship Allah, get out." You know, and then comes the bloodshed. So yeah, it is very it's a scary force, and it's demonic. I'm going to call it what it is in that regard too. It has shed more blood than any other belief system other than maybe communism. But
well, I've got one I could throw at you. So in some of these conversations, like one thing that I'll hear sometimes is our God is the same, Allah is the same God as the Bible. What do you think of that? Are we dealing with a completely different entity, maybe some kind of demon or made up sort of entity?
I am of the view that the other gods, the other Elohim, are very much real. They're very much created beings. I love Michael Heiser, and I love all of his work, and his work is a huge influence on me as a pastor and as a lover of truth and theology. And even the show, Dr. Michael Heiser, was a huge influence in why the Dancing Toaster even exists. He was willing to have conversations that other Christians weren't willing to have. And I wanted to have those conversations in my own little, theological corner of the body of Christ as a Calvary Chapel pastor. I'm willing to talk about some things that other people in my so-called denomination, they don't like the word denomination, but we kind of are one. But I'd like to talk about things that they otherwise won't touch. And so I believe the entity that founded Islam is very real, but it is not Yahweh. It is not the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. It is a demonic being, a fallen angel. I think Muhammad's experience in that cave, I think he's telling the truth. He had an encounter, and he actually thought it was demonic at first, and he rushed, he wanted to kill himself. He wanted to climb up to the highest mountain and throw himself off after he had this terrifying experience with a supernatural entity in a cave. But he goes home to his wife, and his wife tells him, like, no, this is not demonic. This is good, and you need to listen to this and press into this. And she encouraged him, her and I think a cousin. I may be getting that second person off, but he was encouraged, like, no, this is not bad. This is good. And he embraces the darkness and starts off on this journey of founding a religion, which is kind of why I still covered it. I kind of do two shows. I do the Dancing Toaster and the Man-Eating Toaster. It used to be a member exclusive thing, but it was so fruitful and going so well, I was like, man, I want to make this open to everybody. So my patrons are so supportive, and they were like, yeah, everybody should be hearing this content too. But with the Man-Eating Toaster, also a Ghostbuster reference, same scene in Ghostbuster 2. But with that show, I cover cults and bizarre true crime. And I approached Islam as though it were a cult, because it tries to take so much of the other Abrahamic faiths. Muhammad, he had a nickname that basically was like calling him a parrot. Like, he would hear things and he would repeat it. And he was illiterate, so he couldn't write any of it down, but he had it dictated. And he would hear Jewish myths and Christian myths. That's why he got a little bit of the Old Testament in there, but you see a little bit of Jewish mysticism. You see a little bit of the later Christian doctrine that wasn't Christian, that was kind of, we're all saying, hey, this isn't actually sound, but he was like, oh, I'll take that too. And so he begins taking whatever he hears, because he's in the center of the religious world, out there in the Middle East. So he's taking all these ideas in, and he's just reiterating them and repurposing them and rebranding them. And he creates this system, and he even thought, like, hey, when we introduce this stuff to the Jews, they're going to love me. They're going to love this thing that we got going on. But then when he started approaching other groups, especially predominantly Jewish groups, they kind of laughed at him. They were like, what are you talking about? That's not at all what the texts say. And that was kind of the early seeds of his later hatred for that particular group of people. Anyways, I do not think we worship the same God. I do believe him to that Allah is a real entity, but he is most likely maybe Baal from the Old Testament. What his specific moniker is, I think there's a fixed number of these entities that simply have rebranded over the years, depending on the culture, the time, and who they were, you know, presenting themselves to. That's why an Odin can have so much in common with a Zeus, even though there's different parts of the world, different cultures, but there's so many parallels between the two. Are they just the same entity portraying themselves in a different way? I think all the entities are real. I think there is one God, capital G, if you will, but all the other gods, lowercase g, that's how we kind of differentiate in the English, but the Bible just uses the same term, Elohim. I believe those beings are real. I believe they're the ones that started all the other religious systems from Islam to Hinduism and even the cults. Man, you look in the Mormonism and Islam, so many parallels that are, you know, from the polygamy to the angelic vision, you know, that. So anyways, I sorry for all the tangents. All this stuff clearly fascinates me, but yeah, it's kind of a shotgun blast.
No worries. Definitely a great answer. I've heard that, I believe it might have been reading Sitchin. I know Heisner has kind of torn him to shreds, but I'm still a little bit of a fan of his work. He said that Allah actually has the same, that the moon symbol is the same as an ancient Anunnaki god named Sin. So that could be it right there. There's a lot of possibilities. Do you feel that, like, today we see a lot of videos and things of Islam and Sri Lanka taking over parts of Europe, England, France, and even here it's starting up a bit in certain areas of, like, Minnesota, where Muslim populations are taking over blocks, entire communities. And they're actually enforcing a Sharia law on the people that live there. There's accounts of, like, raping of, you know, natural born citizens or existing citizens and things like that. Do you feel like Islam is becoming a huge threat to the West once again?
I would say yes, but I would also say it's a little more complicated than that. And depending on, you know, if any point I get too controversial, please let me know and I'll shut up.
You do not have to worry about that on this show.
Okay, cool. No. I have lost invitations because of certain things that I've been pretty vocal about, especially of late, because I accepted the you have to choose sides kind of thing, right? So I'm a pastor. I'm a devout Christian. I love the Lord. I believe Jesus when he said in John 14:6, I'm the way, the truth, the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. I believe that. I've dedicated my life to that reality. I accepted, though, this false dichotomy that you had to choose. Are you going to support the Jews or are you going to support the Muslims? Because, man, I agree with you that the Muslims are currently, I mean, UK cooked. The UK is cooked. When you see what's happening in France, when you see what's happening in Ireland, with the reports recently and the rape gangs and what they're doing, and the fact that, you know, they're not being prosecuted because we don't want to hurt the Muslims' feelings. It's like no. Like it doesn't matter what color they. I don't care about their pigment or their belief system. Wrong should be wrong, but unfortunately, we've allowed stupidity to cloud our judgment and a warped sense of compassion that says, well, they didn't really understand what they were doing. No, actually, the Muslims that are doing it are doing exactly what their prophet did. So I'm not surprised when they do it. But what I was told, especially as a Calvary Chapel guy, and this, like I said, has gotten me into trouble within my own denomination, is like, well, you support Israel, right? You support the Jews because, you know, they're the ones holding back the Muslim hordes. And it's like, no, actually, I Christ is king. I support Christianity. I support my fellow brothers and sisters that are in the faith, that are in Palestine, that are in southern Lebanon, that are currently getting the crap bombed out of them by by the nation of Israel. What's funny is Islam is a threat, but think about what caused all of the migration in the first place. If one particular nation stopped bombing the piss out of all of these other countries, then they wouldn't have to send tens of thousands of migrants to the West. So I know this is controversial to say, but there are those that may be pulling strings that are having us, America, go and bomb the mess out of the Middle East, and then we create all of these migrants that then flood all these other places. So if America, and I love my country, I do. My father served. I put this meme up on my social media yesterday for 4th of July that had Macho Man Randy Savage in a red, white, and blue. It's like when you ask me how much I love America, you know, and it's got Macho Man, you know, but underneath it's got V for Vendetta. And it says, when you ask me how much I love my government, it's got, you know, V from V for Vendetta. So, I believe that this migrant crisis is manufactured, and you simply have to trace money and you have to trace who it benefits. And what you find out is there are those that I believe are marching in tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of Muslim migrants into the Western hemisphere. And the topic can get very controversial very quickly. I see Islam is a threat, to be sure, but there is a smaller group that tends to use them as a battering ram to bust into places that they want to see be destroyed from the inside out. And it's working. It's working. At first, it took out the UK. I think they have recently passed the point of no return. And then for us, Michigan, Minnesota, we live, you know, in the West Coast, we're already very, very soft towards these things, making excuses for those that are from these third world parts of the world and saying, well, you know, we can't prosecute them the same. Their beliefs are different than ours. It's like, no, wrong is wrong, right is right, and if we don't start to correct the wheel, then we're going to be in some big trouble. But we tend to send a ton of money to the place that I think is responsible for flooding the West with all these Muslim migrants.
Yeah, I'm on the same page with a lot of that. Me personally, I don't like. I've had this discussion, and I've become more and more firm as time goes on, but I don't believe that if you are a Muslim, you have the right way. And that stands for other religions and beliefs too. To me, Christ is king. The Bible is the truth. Jesus Christ is the truth. And nothing besides that is really, I don't want to say acceptable. Not that I'm, I'm not the gatekeeper of spirituality or heaven or anything like that. But to me, there's only one true faith, and that is following Jesus Christ. And I don't take any substitutes for that. I feel like if you are a Muslim, then your duty is to convert. I don't feel like you're on the right path, and I'm certainly not going to jump over to that side. But Nelly, have you heard of this guy going around that some people are actually calling the Antichrist the Imam Mahdi? Have you heard of this guy?
The particular name doesn't. I mean, I've heard it, but I can't attach it. I'm gonna look it up while I have you on the line to see if I know exactly. So the specific person doesn't ring any bells to me, but the title does. The Mahdi, within certain sects of the Islamic faith, the Mahdi is a messianic title, right? So you have the Jews that are currently in rebellion against God. The vast majority of devout Jews are awaiting the Mashiach. And then you have on the other side, the Muslims that are awaiting, some of them, not all of them, but those that believe in a messianic hope, which is a lot of them, but I don't know the percentage off top head. But they're waiting for the Mahdi. So the Mashiach, the Mahdi, we as Christians believe that the Messiah already came, that Jesus of Nazareth was the Messiah. And we believe that hundreds of prophecies being fulfilled by him demonstrate that reality. And what's crazy is Muslims show more respect for Jesus than Jews do. Especially with what you see them doing in southern Lebanon right now, destroying churches and smashing, you know, Virgin Mary statues and crucifixes and, excuse me, statues of Jesus just being desecrated and whatnot. So Muslims reject his deity, but still think that he was a legitimate prophet that was to be respected, that he was to be honored. But if you worship him, you're committing shirk. You're holding someone up to be equal with Allah, which is like the worst sin that you can do. So they reject the deity of Jesus, but so do the Jews. The Jews reject his deity. And what's so crazy is I used to be this massive Christian Zionist because of being, you know, my Calvary Chapel background and just growing up in the places that I did. The Jewish faith, I mean, they hate, when you read the Talmud, when you read the Zohar, they hate Jesus. I mean, the Talmud teaches that he's currently boiling in hell in hot excrement, and they, you know, call Mary all kind of manner of things. They say he wasn't God. He was a Jewish magician. And so anyways, you got these two, the other two Abrahamic faiths are awaiting a future figure. And depending upon your eschatological views as a Christian, you may come to the conclusion that the Mashiach that the Jews are waiting for and the Mahdi that the Muslims are waiting for are in fact one and the same figure. And that figure is what many, especially dispensational Christians, would label as the Antichrist, as this great deceiver that's going to come and bring about at first this incredible peace. He's going to get everybody agreeing with one another. But you know, again, depending on one's eschatological views, he'll eventually turn and show that, you know, he wants to be worshipped as God. And there's the tribulation, and you know, you're the namesake for your show, The End of Days. I mean,
I've been hearing that a lot lately, mainly because it's the type of thing that I look up. But one thing that's interesting about that is, there in Revelations, there's supposed to be a degree of persecution against Christians. And for that to happen, you know, what they say, what I think about it is that couldn't possibly be a Christian leader, yet it would have to be some kind of, you know, faith-based type of leader. And when you look at it that way, it does kind of make sense that this person would be a Muslim, because, you know, just like Muslims like to do, they like to chop people's heads off and things like that. So it does kind of make sense that the Antichrist would be part of Islam.
Yeah, the only rebuttal that I could think of is with the Jewish. Let me be clear. Muslims don't have the greatest sentiment towards Jews, but let's just say the feeling's mutual, right? They don't like one another traditionally. And if you look at the groups as a whole, they certainly don't like one another. I'm not saying that there's not a Jew out there with a Muslim friend or vice versa, but the groups largely are not friends with one another. And so when we're talking about a future messianic figure that both groups would accept, I don't see the Jews being willing to accept an Islamic figure. And much of what the Islamic world does is brute force. But what we see from the Jewish world is a lot of subversion. And I'll give an example. One of the things that we see here in the West is this wanting to, I don't know if you're familiar with the Noahide laws, but there are these seven laws that a lot of Christians say, oh, that sounds good. Like it's seven laws that certain Jewish sects are putting forward saying, hey, look, these are seven laws that we can all agree on. They're going to bring unity between Jews and Christians. That's why they made up the term Judeo-Christian. Oh, you know, the Judeo-Christian West. And it's like, no, the West is Christian. But in any case, the Noahide laws slap Noah's name on it and add seven laws that have nothing to do with him. The first one, though, is no idolatry. And a Christian would look at that list and, you know, a Jew would say, hey, see this? And you look at the list and you say, oh, no idolatry. I'm off. Yeah, no idolatry. But you got to wait. What do they mean by that, though? Because when you read guys like Maimonides, who was one of their most famous rabbis, he was very clear. And they love this guy. They name hospitals after this guy. And they love this guy, you know. And so Maimonides was very clear that Christians are idolaters because we worship Jesus as a God. We worship him as not as a God, but as the one true God, that he is Yahweh incarnate. And because we worship Jesus, according to the Talmud and the Zohar, are, and according to rabbinic Judaism and those Noahide laws that they would love to have enforced on the whole world, we would be condemned as idolaters, and under the truest sense of their rules, not just the Muslims, under their rules, we too would also be put to death. So we got both groups that that reject the deity of Jesus, and both groups, if they had their way, if they were the predominant force and power and could enforce like Sharia law, Christians are in trouble, because you either are going to take a subservient position in their society and pay something called the jizya, which is like a religious tax, right? But you can't proselytize. You can't be vocal about your faith. God forbid you open a church, right? Look at how many mosques are available in America and in the UK, but then try to find churches in Saudi Arabia. You won't find them, right? And so, both of the other Abrahamic faiths, all of us are claiming exclusivity. And all of us have very strong views about Jesus. And because Christians believe Jesus is Yahweh incarnate, Muslims would have us killed under Sharia law. But if the Antichrist figure was under the banner of Judaism, we would also be put to death under the Noahide laws for idolatry. And a lot of Christians don't know that, because if we did, we wouldn't be so avidly and bloodthirstily Zionist in our approach.
Yeah, that's a lot of good information right there. One thing that I learned that I should have known a long time ago, and I actually had to get in some arguments with some rabbinical type of Israeli citizens, where, you know, we as Christians read the Bible, and it talks about, you know, Israel, the body of Christ, and things like that, and in end times, you know, the return of Christ, and Christ actually ruling the earth after that point, which would be great because he's God and nobody could rule the earth better than God. But what the classic Hebrew religion, I guess we'll call it that, believes is that no, Jesus, there's no Jesus, and in end times it's actually going to be the people that live in Israel that will become an elite class and rule over the rest of mankind. And I hate to say it, Nelly, but I was pretty horrified to hear that. That doesn't sound like a feature I'd want to be part of.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is very complicated, right? Because I am wrestling even myself over the last year as I've learned certain things with the release of the Epstein files, with my discovery of things, you know, like the USS Liberty and those kinds of things, like just going down certain rabbit holes that were started by the release of, a portion of the Epstein files. It really got me thinking about a lot of things and questioning a lot of things. And the more I pulled on certain threads, the more uncomfortable it got, the scarier certain things got, to be sure. And so much Christian theology has been negatively influenced by an obsession with Jewish theology, because what modern Judaism is not biblical Judaism. And I can prove that, because ever since Jesus actually prophesied about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, and it happened just like he said that it would. But after the destruction of their temple in Jerusalem by the Romans, their entire, I mean, they were scattered. The diaspora occurs. They're scattered. Many of them, you know, many were still in Babylon, but many of them go back to Babylon, and they start getting together and putting together the Babylonian Talmud. How do we practice our faith when we no longer have the center of our entire existence on this planet, which was the temple? So it's like the priest system, the sacrificial system, all the laws, all of these things were all wrapped up into being able to utilize the temple. Now, Christian theology, especially the book of Hebrews, man, love that book. The more I read that book, the more fascinated I am. Jesus fulfilled everything the Old Testament was talking about. He is the fulfillment of everything that temple was ever meant to point to, but they rejected him, right? And so God has that temple destroyed. He uses the Romans as the stick that crushes their temple, their idol, because it had become an idol and they weren't worshiping him in it. Jesus said, if you actually loved God, you would hear me. You would listen to me. Those who deny the Son, he says, they don't have the Father, right? So after their rejection of the Mashiach, the real one, Jesus Christ, after that rejection, there's this great apostasy that takes place among them. Their temple is destroyed. So they now get together in Babylon and they have to figure out how can we still, what's our identity? What's our religion look like now when the major part of our religion is now gone? And that's where rabbinic Judaism comes from, or Talmudic Judaism comes from. The Talmud, man, it's just obnoxious. I mean, it would take up several shelves behind me if I had that vile series of books, but I don't. I have it digitally, but I don't have the printed one. But in it is a lot of their beliefs and thousands of pages of discussions among rabbis and things, and how they're going to now exercise their faith in absence of a temple. And a lot of those things, unfortunately, have negatively influenced Christian theology. And I'm still, that long tangent was to say that as a Calvary Chapel pastor, there are certain things that I've been wrestling with eschatologically, specifically, how much of my eschatology was shaped by what the Bible actually says, and how much of it was shaped by the likes of Darby and Schofield and things like that. And for example, like you had mentioned, Christians being heavily persecuted during this future time period. Well, that raises some questions, right? Because as a Calvary Chapel guy, one of the biggest doctrines that they hold dear is the pre-tribulation rapture of the church. So there's this idea that, well, we're going to be zapped out before the worst of this crap ever happens, right? That's the belief that is held. But I've wrestled with that. When you see a lot of the pages of or the passages about the persecution of Christians, is it going to be because we're still here? Is it going to be because there are going to be those that are saved during that time, but are going to have a hell of a time? Is that what is being said there? And I mean that like it will be hell on earth for them during that time. But yeah, their belief about their, whether it's a Mashiach or whether it's them as a corporate group, they do believe that the world will be dominated, that everyone else will be subjugated by their Mashiach, and that if you're a devout follower of another faith, you're probably going to die, because the very first rule, no idolatry. Under the Noahide laws, you're done. But if you're a secular Gentile, then as long as you follow those seven Noahide laws, you can be allowed to stay. Although the Talmud says that you'll just be lucky to be alive at that point. But they will need servants, and so they're going to allow some to live. That's kind of how modern rabbis talk about it. And I mean, I've seen an endless stream of reels of just listening to rabbis talk about this. So yeah, I was equally alarmed by reading their own sources and then listening to their own rabbis talk about this, and that they very much view this as a time of Gentile subjugation and them ruling the world either as a group or under their false Messiah. But what's crazy is if dispensationalism and that kind of brand of eschatology is true, that's precisely what Antichrist is going to do. I think he'll do it under the banner of Judaism, but halfway through the tribulation, my view still, and I'm open to be convinced otherwise, but is that he will show his true colors. He will, Jesus talked about the abomination of desolation spoken of in Daniel. He didn't talk about it as a past tense thing. He talked about it as future tense. And so I tend to think that it's still an event that's going to come in the future, that this false messianic figure that they will worship, that they will accept, is set foot in another temple, one that they're trying really hard to build. Even as we speak, they're trying to set up everything about that, and is going to demand to be worshipped as God, and is going to turn on them in a very dark, dark way. And the latter part will be worse than the first.
Yeah, there's been a lot of corresponding evidence in the moves that have been made. And signs as well in the sky. Like, for example, I believe it was early March, we had the eclipse, the blood eclipse which is very similar to the prophecy in, I believe, Revelations 5. And then we had the drying of the Euphrates, which is another very strong prophecy, as well as the timing of the prophecy of Christ's fig tree generation, where the fig tree represents Israel and the reestablishment of Israel by the Rothschilds back in, what was it, the
early
1948, which corresponds to a life. The Bible in Psalms says a lifetime is about, what, 70, 80 years. And we, according to that prophecy, the end times would be starting at about 2027, 2028, along with Israel preparing the red heifers for sacrifice. So we have all these. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. No, I was just going to say somebody brought up the red heifers as well in the comments. Just
oh,
now.
Yeah, here we go. Yeah, from Kilburn. Thank you.
Yeah, so with that, with I tend to stay away best I can from date naming, especially Calvary Chapel itself has gotten in trouble in the past for that kind of stuff. Even Pastor Chuck, bless his heart, love him to death, but he toyed around a little too much with that for my comfort. But you know, when Jesus said, "No one knoweth the day or the hour," I tend to just hold to that. I see he did say, "Be aware of the signs and times." You know, it's a foolish generation that doesn't look at the signs, doesn't look at the time. So I'm of the belief that, you know, we are in unprecedented times, to be sure. But the red heifer stuff specifically is interesting. I tend to get really annoyed, especially now, with Christians that want to help usher in, like imagine a Christian that says, "Oh, I want to send money to Israel so they can build the next temple," because they think they're trying to usher in eschatological events. Like, "Oh, I want Jesus to return sooner, and I know that they're going to need a temple." But it's like, stop and listen to yourself for a second. You sound like Judas. That's like Judas saying, "Oh man, I really want Jesus to hurry up and usher in his kingdom, so I'm going to force his hand. I know I'm going to sell him out to the Rome or to the Jewish authorities, so he has to reveal himself." He certainly wouldn't let them kill him. And then it's like, "Oop, yeah, he did," because that was kind of the whole point. You missed it, Judas. But trying to help usher these things, the Bible does not say to do any of that. The only thing that's even remotely hinted at that could expedite the time of the end is proselytizing. Is to, in Romans, it talks about the number of Gentiles being filled. So I'm of the belief that when the number of Gentiles comes into God's family, he knows the number, he knows the people. When that number is filled, it's gonna okay, now it's time. The end of the end is going to begin. And like I said, that's my current theological framework. I'm open to be persuaded, but the whole red heifer business is another, you know, you got professing Christians out in Texas trying to breed the specific animal that's going to be used. But it's like, this is all blasphemous. They hate Jesus. So you want to help them create a temple that he will be blasphemed in. You want to help them have the animals that they can offer as sacrifices instead of the Hebrew says once and for all sacrifice that was offered by our Savior. So it's like, why would you want to help them blaspheme our Savior? And I feel like that's what they're doing.
Come to think of it, sorry for interrupting you, but
oh no, you're good. I keep going too long.
I forget. No worries. But it just made me think of back when the current Iran war was starting. There was news stories coming out saying that generals were telling the soldiers, "We have to do this because we got to bring upon end times. We got to get Christ to return." That's exactly what you were talking about just now.
Mm-hmm. And I talked about that exact moment where that general said that. I have an episode where I covered that because I was livid when I heard that. And that's the bastardization of the Christian faith. And that's what so many American Christians have been spoon-fed for decades now. And I too was one of them. I too was one of them until I started doing, you know, a little more critical thinking and realizing that, man, it's far more complex than I realized. And even when you go into Romans 9, when he's talking about, you know, between Romans 9 and 11, it's a very complex passage. And it's why I still believe that ethnic Israel, whoever they may be, those that are biological descendants of Abraham, I think that they will ultimately see some of them, a portion of them. It doesn't have to be a certain number, but some of them will see when Jesus does return and they see the Son of David sitting on a throne in Jerusalem. I believe some of them will be the fulfillment of the remaining Old Testament prophecies that are still waiting to be checked off. Because I do believe in his first advent, he fulfilled hundreds of prophecies, and that there are still dozens more that will be fulfilled during his second advent. And I believe some of those will be, again, descendants of Abraham looking at the Son of David sitting on a throne. They don't know it's Jesus yet, but they will find out in because of his mercy, they will, some of them get to see that. But yeah, that general that was like, oh, we got to light the beacon, you know, of judgment day. And it's like, that's sick. That's sick. And you're using my religion as a tool of warfare and emotional manipulation and spiritual manipulation of thousands of people. How we've been battling in the Middle East my entire life. We've been blowing up brown people in the desert, and saying we're doing it for these righteous causes. And some of my earliest memories of what's going on in the Middle East, even before I was a Christian or a pastor or anything like that, was, you know, them WMDs that we were supposed to find in Iraq. Yeah. That weren't there, you know. So, you know, forgive me if I'm told Iran has nuclear weapons, sir. They don't. They don't, because you just told us a few months ago that they were taken out. Now we have to go there to take them out. Which is it? Did you take them out?
Same excuse.
Yes,
they're literally using the exact same propaganda. It's like, really, people, you're gonna believe that whole thing a second time?
Yes.
After George W. Bush was shoving that down our throats, you're really gonna buy that exact same narrative from another Republican president? And you know, that's so true what you're saying, because literally all of it is trying to force the end times, starting from 1948, the Rothschilds reestablishing Israel, to forcing people in Gaza to relocate. I know people aren't moving there, but still, you know, forcing them to relocate, expanding territory in order to rebuild the temple and things like that. It's all this forced sort of apocalypse, and there's no way that can be right. You don't achieve a spiritual end through bloodshed.
They definitely are not on the side of righteousness as Huckabee or Lindsey Graham would have you believe, that they're not the good guys. And the same bad intel that we were given in Iraq, BB, thanks BB, you know, go send Bush to go trace down WMDs, and now, you know, he has his current puppet chasing nuclear weapons in Iran that they never had. And a bunch of people have needlessly died, and it's all for this expansion project, because they are trying to force certain eschatological events in Christians. The fact that there are so many Christians that would actively participate in trying to force the hand of God, it's so manipulative. When you really think about it, it is some of the ultimate manipulation. Yahweh will not be manipulated. You cannot twist his arm to do what you want him to do. So, you know, that's why anything popping off in the Middle East and suddenly somebody's like, it's the end. You've been saying that for God knows how long. As long as I've been alive, even before I was a Christian or a pastor, I've been hearing the same song. And what we do every time we do that is, the alarmism just makes people believe less and less and less in anything that we have to say. And the more we defend that stuff, and that's the real kicker. Another thing that really helped me being up in the Pacific Northwest is meeting people that disagree with me, that don't agree with me. And especially as it pertains to a little plot of land in the Middle East and just who has the right to be there and what actually did happen. I just recently did another episode that talked about some Israeli war crimes, and I specifically picked the majority of them or all before October 7th, because anytime you bring up this particular topic with anybody, oh, but October 7th, then it's like, well, let's go back to what was happening in the 1940s, the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. Hamas and Hezbollah didn't even exist yet. And speaking of them, Southern Lebanon really breaks my heart, because there's so many Christians in Southern Lebanon, and I see Christians celebrating. I see Western Christians excited about Israel, forcing their way up into Lebanon as a buffer zone. And it infuriates me, because our brothers and sisters are having their homes obliterated, their hospitals and schools obliterated. And these are other Christians. And you have, you know, Zionist Christians over here seeing this as a positive thing or something. Well, they have to protect themselves. And it's like, I used to watch South Park. I don't anymore for obvious reasons. It's a pretty rough show, right? But back early episodes of South Park, I think it's the uncle and his friend are taking the boys hunting, and they would point and they'd be like, oh, it's coming right for us. Because they were hunting illegally, and they, oh, it's coming right for us. And they would shoot it. And the kids were like, wait a minute. It wasn't coming at us. Yes, it was. You know, they had to say it was going to attack them so that they could shoot it and not be prosecuted by the law. Right. So, oh, it's coming right for us. Boom. Oh, that one too. It's coming right for us. Boom. And I feel like, especially, when you see it, what's been done in Gaza, it's just so heartbreaking. And it's like, you mean to tell me every inch was occupied by Hamas? They must have one of the largest armies in the world. If you literally needed to level miles and miles and miles and miles of real estate. And now in southern Lebanon, oh, Hezbollah's over there. Blow up that hospital. Oh, Hezbollah's over there. Blow up that high school. Oh, we got to blow up this neighborhood because Hezbollah. And it's like, it's coming right for us. You see what I'm saying? Like, is the Hezbollah in the room with us right now? You know?
Yeah, it's in the book 1984, where they create the terrorist as a way to go after anybody that's bucking the system. It's the exact same game plan. And it's scary because, you know, somebody's putting that stuff out there and telling us what's going on. But I don't know if it's a problem with the education level or just too much propaganda out there, but you know, you have that term Christian Zionism, but those two terms don't really, they can't go together.
They shouldn't, right? They really shouldn't, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, kind of going a little deeper into this whole thing, you know, the Epstein files, obviously the big topic of the day. And when you actually get in there and read them, you know, you see all these sort of connections, you know, the things you're talking about, mm-hmm. but society collectively just can't really see them because they're so afraid of that blowback. You know, these layers and layers of deception, it's right there in front of us, but we can't even talk about it because it's literally the idea of offending this certain class of people is overpowering the fact that most people really hate pedophiles. And that alone is just terrifying, the implications of that.
Yeah, one of the most successful psyops of world history. Yes, some egregious things have been done to a particular group of people. I will not deny that. But when they said never again, what they really meant is never again to us. Because ever since the never again of the 1940s, of the Holocaust, ever since then, they have become the very thing that they claim to stand against. They have become that. And it's so scary. But the Epstein files also, because once you again start pulling on the thread, okay, Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell's daddy, Robert, owning the Pergamum Press subsidiary is the ones that published yours and my textbooks growing up in school, right? McGraw-Hill. So it's like, our textbooks, the indoctrination started really early. It started very early to where we are beat over the head. You'd think, and again, I'm not the Holocaust, awful thing, right? But you would think growing up in America and hearing about that atrocious event, you'd think that's the only thing that's ever happened in human history. Like, and we have like, you know, 400 movies that exist that talk about this one particular event and stuff, and all of this stuff to constantly put it in front of us to remind us. And it's to keep the victimhood narrative going so that you feel guilty being critical of this particular group of people. And just like I said, I love Muslims. I hate Islam. I love Jewish people. I hate Zionism. It is not a hatred of Jewish people. Zionism is a political ideology that was started by you know, atheist Jews that didn't even care about God. The funny thing is many of the early Zionists, they didn't care about religion, but they knew it would be such a powerful tool to manipulate people's heartstrings. And it worked. It worked with the Christians, and it worked with other Jews. Like, oh yeah, maybe this is ours, and let's go take it. And then, you know, but again, it's with the Epstein files. I began pulling threads, and I was like, oh man, this is very unsettling. This is incredibly unsettling. And that was where, oh, this is funny. This is where I learned about the word goyim. I was like, what's that? You know, and I find out it's a derogatory term that's used of
it's
Gentiles.
Us.
It's us. You know, it's me. And you know, it's me. I joke, maybe I get a tattoo right here, goyim. You know, just as a mockery, you know, because that, but I thought it was just the Muslims. And it goes back to something I said a little while ago, probably halfway through the program, where I said, we've been, a lot of the news right now is trying to get you to hate Muslims. I don't hate Muslims. I love Muslim people. I hate Islam. I hate the religion. I do. I believe it's it has demonic origins. I believe it's satanic. I believe it's destroying women and children. I believe it's bad. I believe Islam is a negative force in the world. But I believe Talmudic Judaism is a negative force in the world as well. They rejected their Messiah. And after they did that, they began to embrace all manner of wicked ideologies and the Talmud. I mean, it's such an intimidating set of documents, thousands upon thousands of pages. They added 2,000 to 3,000 different laws on top of the 613 that already existed in the Old Testament for Jews. So it's like, they added all of these elements, and it is a negative force in the world. It is a supremacist ideology. And I got to see that in the Epstein files, just how certain members of this community talk about Gentiles, talk about goyim, you know, goy being singular, goyim being the plural. And I knew Muslims talked about us like pigs. I knew they talk about us like pigs, especially, you know, Christians and Jews are looked upon as pigs. But to this other group that I thought was an ally, our greatest ally, they see us as cattle. So that's why I'm like, Christ is king. I want Jesus to come and establish his kingdom, and everyone will lose. You know, even within the Christian community, all these doctrinal arguments that we're all having, when he comes, so many of those things are not going to matter anymore. Some of the things that professing Christians argued about in comment sections for, you know, decades and decades, and made their sole issue, like, I need to make every Christian think exactly like me on this one point, or they're a heretic. And it's like, man, when Jesus cracks the sky and he comes back, and regardless of when it happens, and whether or not we're here when it happens, or we're coming back with him, depending on your view, he is going to return, because he said he would. He says, I go to prepare a place for you, and I'm going to come again for you. If it were not so, I would not have told you. So he's coming back one way or another. And when he does, when he cracks the sky, everybody's going to know about it. And you know, every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And by then, they won't have a choice. They won't have a choice. We will not be bowing to them. They and us will be bowing to Jesus.
Quick question from the chat. This is from Liz 490. Question: any thoughts on the 1933 pageant at Chicago's World's Fair, A Romance of the People? Is that familiar to you at all? I don't know anything about that one.
Yeah. Full confession. I know exactly what they're talking about, but I don't know the details. So I slapped it in my Google search real fast just to quickly refresh my memory on the specific details. But it was put on. The Romance of People was a massive historical pageant staged at Chicago's Soldier Field on July 3rd, 1933, to celebrate Jewish Day at the Century of Progress World's Fair. Drew a staggering crowd, 125,000 spectators, blah, blah, blah. Produced by Meyer Weisgall of the Zionist Organization of America. Okay, so a lot of this is just boilerplate stuff. As far as I know, with this particular event, depending on who you ask, some pretty dark things occurred at this particular event. When you ask me who I believe Muslims worship, if I believe that Muslims and Jews were, or Muslims and Christians worship the same God, I said emphatically no. If you ask me, do Christians and Jews worship the same God? My answer is still emphatically, no, we do not. Because Jesus said, if you don't have the Son, you don't have the Father. So they, ever since they rejected Yahweh incarnate, they have opened themselves up for deception. Now, they're not new to this deception. They're not immune to spiritual deception. Go through the Old Testament. One of the most condemning documents of this elitist group is the Old Testament. How many times did they go astray and worship the gods of the nations, the gods of the land of Canaan? How many times did they begin to kill their own children for Moloch? They did some really dark stuff, child sacrifice and things like this. We're finding the mounds now that have hundreds of infant bodies in them. And since, infant mortality was just higher back then. It's like, no. This goes in line with what we're told they were doing in the Old Testament. But again, how many times was this a wayward people? And Jesus said it himself. The apostles said it themselves. Jesus, how many times did you kill your messengers? Did you persecute the prophets that were sent to you? Stephen in his sermon before he was murdered, same thing. You killed the prophets. You killed God. You've killed the prophets. They've been a wayward people, and so too were we. I mean, the Bible says every one of us has gone astray. The Gentiles, it's not like we were better, but they, with this elitist attitude, thinking they're better than all of us lowly Gentiles, it's like, no, how many times did you go and worship these pagan gods and do atrocious things? Now, the reason I brought that up, tying it back to this festival, is depending on who you ask, some very interesting ceremonies are said to have occurred at this particular event that were, it looks like, offering in this Moloch looking thing, this Baal looking thing, throwing ceremonial kids into this thing. It's like, why the heck would you act that out? That is, I wouldn't think that's a part of your history you'd want to be reminiscing. And of course, some, depending on who you ask, some will say, well, no, they were actually sacrificing kids. Some will say, oh, it was all theatrics and stuff. Either way, it's bad. Either way, it's bad. These were things that Yahweh said were abhorrent. And so, that particular day, I think is a dark day that reveals, again, I don't believe modern Jews, Talmudic Jews do not worship Yahweh. They rejected Yahweh incarnate when he came. They need to be proselytized. Preach the gospel to Jews if they'll listen. Read Isaiah 53 to them, but read it without title or context. Just start reading the words and they'll say, oh, you're talking about that Jesus guy. Oh, you think so? Actually, that's your guy. That's Isaiah. That's your prophet. And I saw this Messianic Jew going, around talking to other Jews, and he was, speaking to them in Yiddish, and he's reading, no context, just he's reading Isaiah 53. It just didn't say Isaiah 53 with chapter and verse divisions. And he starts reading it, and they're like, oh, that's that Jesus guy. And he goes, oh, it's funny you said that, because that's one of ours. That's Isaiah. And they're like, what? Because that's a passage they've buried. They hate that passage, or the rabbis try to explain it away. They say, oh no, it's talking about Israel. It's not talking about that Jesus guy. It's talking about Israel. And it's like, but it talks about substitutionary sacrifice on two or three occasions. When did Israel ever sacrifice itself for the world or even for each other? Never, never. Only Messiah did that. And he has a name, Jesus.
Yeah, it's interesting that this conversation has drifted this way, because it's actually part of my questions I was going to ask, but cool. I love that it's gone in this direction. This whole thing about these Canaanite gods, I mean, we're told that people like the Rothschilds and the Habsburgs and people like that are Jewish, but if you look at all these ceremonies, like at the Olympic Games, or the stuff that was going on around CERN, that whole tunnel, that presentation that they were doing, and not just these examples, but there's like millions of them if you were to really look into it and break it down. I believe they're even going to make a archway of Baal in New York City at one point. Then they had to change the name because people were finding out what was going on. So they decide to call it something else, and they did end up building it. But these people say that they're Jewish, but then we hear that they're worshiping these Canaanite gods. Mm-hmm. So it makes you wonder, like, are these even Jews, or are these actually the enemies of the Jews? Are these the Canaanites that are behind a lot of things happening right now in the world?
Yeah, that's where it gets even more controversial. And I'll be frank, I'm undecided on their genetic makeup. And I think that's also intentional, because if you know anything about what's going on in that part of the world, genetic tests or DNA tests and things like that are where you find your history or whatever. They don't like those over there for some reason. Just saying, I do find two passages in the book of Revelation to be very interesting, where it talks about those who say they are Jews, but they are not. It's the synagogue of Satan passages that have been heavily controversial, but it's not anti-Semitic to be reading the Bible, though. If they get their way, they will make sure that we're unable to talk about certain things. They say, oh, the Muslims, they want to make sure that Christians can't practice their faith. And I want to say, yeah, but if we're being really honest, if you had your way, I wouldn't be able to practice my faith either. So again, Christ is king. I don't want either side of you to win. I don't want Muslims to win, and I don't want Jews to win. I want Jesus to win, and he will. And we know in the end he will win. Christ is king and will conquer. How much pain do we go through down here between these other two groups fighting it out? Only time will tell. But yes, are they actually Jew? I do believe that there are still biological descendants of Abraham floating around. Even that term anti-Semitic is very fascinating, because it basically means anti-Shem. And Shem isn't just Jews. They've hijacked the whole term and said it just applies to us. We can only use it. But if we're being honest, the Arab world, descendants of Shem, they're just, if what's happening to the citizens of Palestine could just, that's anti, is that anti-Semitic? Because they're descendants of Shem, and what you're doing to them is highly anti-Semitic, slaughtering them simply because by virtue of who they are. And so, I mean, even finding out, you know, I remember the first time I heard the term, you know, Palestinian Christian, I was like, wait, that's a thing? And I hate to admit that, but that's how hard the indoctrination is in the West, and, you know, what we were inherited from boomers, and you know, with what I inherited as a Calvary Chapel individual. But in any case, are they actually the descendants of Abraham? Many of them are. Another thing I didn't know existed was anti-Zionist Jews. Just recently, I mean, within the last 2 months, there have been groups feuding in the streets of Israel, because you got some groups that are calling out, like, what we're doing is wrong, it's evil. Even many of them, I've listened to rabbis that are anti-Zionist rabbis that are saying, God sent Babylon to destroy us and send us out because of our rebellion, and we should still be sent out. We should have never come back. And it's just fascinating. I'm not saying I agree. I was fascinated that there are other views in this, because we've been forced to pick a side. And it's like, well, it's not that simple. Neither side is my friend or my ally. But even within the sides, there are degrees and variations. So are they the biological descendants of Abraham? Some of them are. Which ones? I don't know. I a lot of them have more European DNA than Shemite DNA, but we're not allowed to do the tests, because that ambiguity is part of the plan. In my opinion, the ambiguity is intentional, because is it an ethnicity or is it a religion? Well, technically, they'd say, well, it's both. It's both. And it's like, well, that's how they pull the wool over your eyes, right? Because it's like, if I'm critical of the religion, am I being critical of the people? I would say no. But because they like to play the shell game and swap it out and say, oh, and it's just a way of beating us over the head with anti-Semitism. And that used to be one of the scariest things you could have called me. I would have perished the thought, right, that somebody called me anti-Semitic, right? Because I don't hate Jewish people, even though that's technically not the word, what the word means. But that's how it's used semantically. And I would have been like, oh my gosh, please no. But now the word means nothing. They've overused it. They've applied it to everything. And I love Jews. I want to see them come to know their Messiah, the real one that came for them, that loved them, that stood on the hillside overlooking Jerusalem. And it says he wept, and he said, oh, how I would have gathered you, but you would not, you know. So the ones that really are, you know, I believe many of them will come around in due time. Some of the most deadly ones that are in the highest positions of power, I don't know. I just think it's interesting. Revelation has two passages: those who say they are Jews, but they are not, you know, synagogue of Satan, Bibi Netanyahu, monster, Ben-Gavir, monster, you know, go down the list of their highest officials. The vast majority of them are monsters. The more I learn about them and the things that they have facilitated and some of the things that they've said, their own words condemn them. And, so yeah, I, with my paranormal podcast, you wouldn't think that these topics are ones that I talk about, but I've been really passionate about them lately. But they are supernatural because there are beings behind these things, orchestrating these things, and they are the gods of the nations. They are the other Elohim. They are the ones that have pulled the wool over the eyes of the Islamic world into thinking they're worshiping the one true God, but Allah is a false god. And even, you know, it's interesting because if you're a professing Jew, but you follow Kabbalah in any way, Kabbalah, I just did another episode. My most recent episode is over an hour where I talk about the historical origins and the overall, like, 3,000-mile view, you know, of Kabbalah. And I mean, it gets really messy. They believe in a God behind God. I mean, they don't even say Yahweh is the real deal. The real deal is this thing called Ein Sof that's too big for you to understand or to believe or to relate with. So God, the best analogy, and I'm stealing this. I didn't come up with this. I heard it on a YouTube video. Think of, like, the Ein Sof is Geico, right? This major corporation that's hard for you to, that's made up of stuff that's too big to kind of grasp or interact with on an individual level. But the Geico lizard, the mascot, you know, it can represent and speak for on behalf of Geico, the company, right? Well, Ein Sof is the real thing, the corporation, and Yahweh is just the mascot. They don't believe he's even actually God, that it's actually a God behind God. And they don't like that terminology because they still are trying to pretend to be monotheist, but Ein Sof is a demon. He is not God. He is a fallen angel because they have rejected the one true God, who wrapped himself in humanity, who dwelt among men, who lived a perfect life, who died a substitutionary death, and who rose again to prove he was God and prove he had the authority to grant us the forgiveness of our sins. So, when it comes to this group of people, who are they really? The ambiguity is intentional. It is intentional because technically anybody can claim to be one. I mean, you just have to come from one of those parts in Europe where they, you know, flooded the promised land from and say, I converted. And
yeah, exactly. I believe that if you were to follow the bloodlines, there was a point where certain northern Canaanite tribes or Canaanite tribes in general migrated north and joined with the people of the steppes of the Caucasus. And we're talking about people like the Scythians, which have a very interesting culture behind them, a lot of blood drinking and things like that. I believe personally that there's a synergy between these groups, which later became the Khazarians, and dispersed westward. Of course, they'll come up with all kinds of tests and things like that to say that's not true. But it says in the Bible, know them by their works. So I think it's pretty clear who we're dealing with. There's the idea of Jezebel, who was pulling, you know, you mentioned this earlier, but pulling Jews in the direction of worshiping Baal, which means Lord, but specifically we're talking about Baal Hadad, the Canaanite god of thunder and chaos, as well as Moloch and deities like that. The whole thing about the Star of Remphan and the god Chiun, which is possibly Saturn. There's a lot to unravel there. But it's certainly not Jesus Christ that they're worshiping.
It's not Jesus. It's not the God of the Old Testament. It's one of, if not multiple, of the other gods that they fell for the first time after they rejected Jesus, their Messiah. They're now worshiping those other entities because they're not a monolith, right? There are groups within this. Just like I said, there are anti-Zionist Jews. There are, you know, you got the Chabad Lubavitch group that are a messianic group that want to usher in the Messiah. Well, actually, they think they have the Messiah, Schneerson is a guy that died in 1994, and they think he's going to come back in some way, that he was their Mashiach, and they're trying to bring him back. And even some of those tunnels underneath synagogues in New York where the,
oh man, that's just weird.
Certain rituals that are being conducted, ask some of them, I heard one being interviewed in particular on a podcast. I don't recall the name off the top of my head just because I take in too much content. But, you know, they're almost trying to usher in his return through some of these ceremonies. And I'm like, whoa, hold the phone. This is evil. Like, you're not supposed to be doing ceremonies in tunnels under New York. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're so far from the Lord. But it all started in 70 AD. Actually, it started in the 30s AD. When Christ was crucified, resurrected, and they did everything they could to try to cover it up. And then Jesus allows the Romans to obliterate their temple, shattering their previous identity, whoever they were or whatever they were. The synagogue brand of Judaism, the early seeds of it were in the first century, but by second and third, when you're getting into the Talmud and they're really solidifying some of their beliefs, the beliefs are abhorrent. They have nothing to do with the Old Testament or the actual God of the Bible. So even if they are genetic descendants of Abraham, they do not worship the God of Abraham. Even the ones that might say that they do, they just don't, because Jesus said, if you don't have the one who sent me, if you reject me, if you believed me, you'd have both the Father and the Son. But because you reject the Son, you don't have the Father either. And for me, that was a really big moment in my life, because I felt like, and I think somebody might have even said it in the comments, but I'm horrible at multitasking. But one of the most eye-opening things was that the answer was there in front of me all along. I mean, they've been falling for false gods for centuries, right? And then when God walked among them, God incarnate walked among them, they hated him. And the religious elite in Israel hated him and orchestrated his crucifixion. Even the early apostles believed that, you know, you killed God. You know, Peter, Stephen, both very direct as far as accountability. You know, Pilate washed his hands of it, you know.
He was smart enough to not want anything to do with that.
Exactly. His wife had a vision. You know, God gives her a vision and she said, have nothing to do with this man. Right? He hands him over. He has blood on his hands, as far as I'm concerned. That doesn't absolve him necessarily, but the same time, you know, they very much,
it says something.
Yeah, for sure. So, oh, it's awful, awful, awful.
You know, man, this is just such a deep topic, and I absolutely love exploring it. The thing that really bothers me about some people is they seem to believe that God is in their blood. And I think Christ already made it very clear that bloodlines don't matter when when we read the story of him and the Canaanite woman. And at first he told her, you know, no, I'm not going to heal your, I think it was her daughter. I'm not going to heal your daughter because, you know, you're a Canaanite. This is for the people of Israel. And then she just said something about, well, even a dog gets scraps from the master's table. Then he just says, you have very strong faith. Go on.
Yeah, and he commends her. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's one of my favorite parts of the Bible, period.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And another interaction that Jesus has with a woman that's equally as powerful is with the Samaritan woman at the well. When Messiah comes, you know, he'll tell us all things. He's, I am he, you know, it doesn't get any clearer than that. But and also, back then, they were really big on blood still, which is why they loathed the Samaritans that they saw as half-breeds, right? And many of them would take a longer journey just to go around Samaritans so that they could avoid the Samaritans. They would take a longer journey around it. And Jesus's disciples, many of them had those same prejudices. Some had the prejudices against each other. When you think about the guys Jesus was able to bring together, it fascinates me. You got Simon the Zealot. That name implies he was a part of a political organization. And they got Matthew the tax collector. They hated tax collectors because why? They were traitors. They were on the side of the Romans, right? So you got this guy who hates the Romans who starts following Jesus. And then you got this guy that worked for the Romans ripping off his fellow Israelites, right? And Jesus brings them together and says, y'all are both going to follow me and y'all are both going to take this gospel to the ends of the earth, right? But he going through Samaria, that would have shocked them. And they were shocked to come back and find him talking to a Samaritan woman. Talking to a Samaritan, scandal number one. Samaritan woman, scandal number two, but he didn't play by their traditions. And so he's having this conversation with her, and she observes that he's a prophet, because he says, bring me your husband so we can have this conversation. Oh, well, I don't have a husband. He goes, yeah, you've been with five, and the guy you're with now, you're not married to. And she goes, surely you are a prophet, you know? Well, when Messiah comes, she changed the subject to Messiah. When Messiah comes, he's going to show us all things. And, you know, woman, I am he, you know, I'm condensing the story for time, but man, I love that interaction as well, because again, Jesus didn't care about bloodline either. Galatians is so clear that those lines of Jew and Gentile have been absolved, that in Christ we are brought together and have a dual inheritance in Christ. And man, it's so easy to miss that though, when you've been indoctrinated your entire life through the education system, and then even as a Christian, depending on what denomination you got saved in, limited the information that you might have been exposed to, unfortunately. And I was definitely in that camp, getting saved in a Baptist church and eventually making my way to Calvary Chapel as my predominant kind of well of theology and where I was ordained. But yeah, it greatly limited the information that was available to me. And I move up here and I basically, and this, some won't like that I say it this way, but feeling abandoned by my denomination when I came up here to plant, that was the best thing that could have happened, quite frankly, because I was able to start really looking at what I believe, why I believe it. And certain things got stronger, said, no, I'm very confident. And it's, and other things I was like, you know what? I'd like to believe in a pre-tribulation rapture. I hope that's the right view. But man, if it's not, I'm going to prepare as though it's not. I'm going to prepare myself mentally, physically, as though it's not, so that I can bring others hope. If I'm wrong about a pre-tribulation rapture and we're here, whether it's mid or post, whatever your view may be, I'm going to make sure I'm telling Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, atheists, I'm gonna make sure I'm telling them about Jesus from my pulpit, from you know, when I'm walking in downtown Seattle, or when I am on my podcast, you know, and I have all kinds of listeners from the podcast of all different walks of life, which I love, and they've helped me grow, and I'm grateful for them for that.
Yeah, absolutely. People out there up here in the Pacific Northwest, we're not all a bunch of atheists, liberal Marxists. A lot of us still believe in God, and you know, appreciate what you're doing up here. What do you think of the whole idea of Lucifer?
Lucifer, I mean, quite frankly, the term itself is kind of a made up term. It's not his name. I mean, it means light bearer, but it was never intended to be a name. It's been kind of transliterated into a proper name. When you look at the original text, it never is really written like that. That's kind of when it got squeezed, when it got Latinized, when it got squeezed through the Latin, I think around the Vulgate time period. So Lucifer has become synonymous with Satan, colloquially, culturally, Lucifer and Satan. When you say Lucifer, everyone knows what you mean. So I do believe in the figure of Satan, Lucifer. I don't believe that's his name, but those that would follow Luciferianism, a lot of them are what's the word I'm looking for? A lot of them are atheistic, and they're just edgy boys and girls, you know, that are, you know, just trying to get a rise out of evangelicals and stuff. So they've adopted the moniker to just try and upset people, but they don't really believe in the supernatural entity that we would call Satan. So I don't think Lucifer is his name, but I do believe he is a real entity. Revelation 12 reveals that he was the serpent of old. So the Nahash in the garden, Revelation, John the Revelator tells us that Nahash, that serpent, well, the dragon of Revelation, we're told, is the serpent of old, and he's the Nahash, and the Old Testament, man, is so very quiet on this figure. I mean, you'd think, talking to a lot of Christians, you'd think that Satan was all throughout the Bible, and I mean, he is behind the scenes, but Old Testament is really quiet on this figure, and I think that's intentional. I mean, I think yes, in the New Testament and in modern times, I think he has become kind of the sole enemy, the embodiment of all that is in rebellion against God. I think he was the first rebel, and eventually over time, other supernatural rebels rallied behind him. But I always tell people, we give Satan too much credit. He needs an entire administration in order to operate, because he's not equal to God. He's not equal to Jesus. He's not omnipotent. He's not omnipresent. So he can't even be everywhere at once. So he can occupy one space and time, but he's got an entire administration. Ephesians 6 talks a lot about the principalities and the powers and all these things in the heavenlies, right? So he's got an entire administration, a hierarchy of beings exist that are all under him. I do believe that he takes a center role. We see the first supernatural being rebel in Genesis 3, you know, with the serpent. We see him rebel. But then we see a whole group of supernatural beings rebel independent of that figure by Genesis 6, the Bnei Elohim, the sons of God that lay with the daughters of men, right? So this group, this is another rebellion. So you got this first being rebelled by himself, but he inspired other rebels. It says that they saw women they thought were hot. They came and they took them as wives to themselves, and they created the Nephilim, which is a whole other can of worms that I think every show like this talks about. I've talked about him ad nauseum. But he does kind of emerge by the New Testament time period. He does kind of emerge theologically as a central figure of malevolence, that the kingdom of darkness has kind of fallen behind. And Revelation seems to suggest that he's going to, in the same way that God sent the God man, right? The Lord Jesus, I believe Antichrist will be. Anti doesn't just mean against. That prefix anti doesn't just mean against. It means in place of. So he's really trying to operate in place of Jesus. And so whereas the Father sent his Son, you know, we have the ultimate Antichrist figure. Satan is going to have the Antichrist on earth operating as his human embodiment of evil, carrying out his will, just deceiving the masses. And ironically, I think the first thing he'll deceive them with is peace. I think that's what Revelation teaches about, you know, especially with the four horsemen and whatnot. But that's my thoughts on Lucifer or Satan specifically, that he emerged as a sole figure of evil. But that was something that developed as the other rebels against God rallied behind him. I think that was, we tend to think that all happened instantaneously. And I don't think that's the story that the Bible tells. I think that's tradition has fed that to us because it's easier to process. But I think the spiritual world is far more complicated than that.
Yeah. Me personally, I guess I get a little confused about the matter, because there is the figure of Lucifer, Satan. And then if we look at the book of Enoch, we have two figures, Azazel and Semyaza, and I wonder if either of them is Satan and Lucifer, or we're talking about a completely different, you know, like you said, a completely different set of events.
No, it's a good question. I've wrestled with that too, and where I've kind of come out on it, and again, I'm willing to be convinced otherwise. I'm not saying I have it figured out, but as it pertains to those particular entities represented in Enoch or named in Enoch, I love the book of First Enoch specifically. I'm no expert in it, but I am fascinated by it. I think it very much shaped the theological understanding of the apostles. They very clearly were exposed to that piece of literature, in my opinion, and I'm not alone on that. Many scholars have concluded, you know, read Jude, read Peter, and even some of the titles of Messiah used throughout the Gospels are very indicative of being influenced by the Enochian literature, especially first Enoch. So I never scoff at that book. I think it's very beneficial. But I don't accept it as scripture personally. I don't accept it the theological term is eluding me for some reason. I don't believe it to be inspired. I do believe it to be a valuable historical text. I do believe it helped shape the theological views. It carried along certain theological truths that I do believe are accurate. And I think the stuff that is accurate is echoed for us by the apostles in Jude, in Second Peter, especially when they're talking about Tartarus, Peter talking about Tartarus, man, that's talking about this place underneath the abode of the dead where supernatural entities are housed. Now, that being said, concerning Samael and Shemyaza, like those particular, were either one of them Satan? Many would say yes. I personally, the reason I don't say yes to that is because Jude tells us what happens to the initial wave of watchers that rebelled, the sons of God or watchers, whatever you want to call them. I believe them to be the same group. And when that group rebelled, and according to Enoch, it was 200. Is that gospel? No, it could have been more, could have been less. I don't know, but it is a good ballpark number to be sure. And so when they rebelled, we're told that they were judged, that they were locked away. Is that the picture that we're given of Satan in the New Testament? Well, no. Peter says that Satan, where is he currently? Is he locked away in Tartarus? No. He says that he goes to and fro upon the earth, seeking whom he may devour. So he's still here. He's not in hell. He's not in Sheol or Tartarus. He's on earth, going to and fro, seeking whom he
may
devour.
Damn it, that's a good point. Well, that's a damn good point. I have to admit.
I appreciate it. That's where I've fallen on it.
I think you've just convinced me, actually.
Oh, well, praise the Lord. I'm willing to be proven wrong. You know, I don't think I have all the answers, but I've wrestled with these things just like you. And living here has humbled me greatly, has humbled me. Just the things that I've gone through in the last 6 years has really crushed me, but in the most beautiful way. And, you know, I like to speak with confidence, with courage and with confidence about the things that I've studied. But I always tell people I'm to the point in my life as a man, as a Christian, as a pastor, I'm open to be convinced. But you're going to have to try real hard because I've worked really hard at coming to some of these conclusions, and I'll be honest with the ones that I'm not too sure about. But
yeah, especially considering we're dealing with the literal father of lies here. So there's a lot of twists, a lot of inversions.
Absolutely.
And, you know, when you're studying history, even mythology, the gods, the Bible, you're digging through layers and layers of deception. And the more you dig, the more you start to see it. We do have another question from Liz490 once again. Thank you for your questions, Liz. Does Pastor Nelly believe the Antichrist has arrived?
Oh, that's a spicy question. Thank you, Liz, for that. I like that question. You may not like my answer, but I like the question, and maybe you will. I don't know. But when it comes to the Antichrist figure, I'm actually very open-minded as it pertains. I think he could be right now. I believe historically, because no one knows the day or the hour, according to Jesus, no one knows the day or the hour but the Father, he said. So that being said, that includes the great adversary. That includes Satan. He doesn't know the day or the hour. So I think historically, he has always had somebody kind of waiting in the bullpen, kind of somebody waiting. There have been figures. How many times has the church come to a conclusion, it must be that guy? You know, even in the 1940s, there was must be that guy, and rewind down the corridor of time and space. You know, even during the first century, there were Christians that thought, oh, Nero must be the guy. And I think in many ways, these figures, that's why John in 1 John talks about antichrists, plural. There's the Antichrist, definite article, but then there are Antichrists, many. And I think Satan has always had somebody waiting in the bullpen, ready to come up, ready to emerge as that figure. Could he be alive today? Oh, man, I think there's some really fascinating candidates. I mean, I don't like Peter Thiel very much, nor do I like Jared Kushner. And I know they're getting a lot of attention right now as far as being potential candidates. And, man, I believe there's a lot of validity to some of the arguments that I've heard. Will I put my name on it? Like, will I say, like, I think it's this person or that person? Not yet. I think it's too early to tell. I do believe Peter Thiel and all of his tech bros are helping to usher in the infrastructure necessary for the Antichrist to deceive and to reign and to control information and control people and those kinds of things. But I do think a lot of Christian alarmism has not helped in this category. You know, as soon as, you know, debit cards became a thing, people like, don't get a debit card. It's the mark of the beast. And I was like, whoa, calm down. You know, that's not, you know, and then when they put chips into debit cards, everyone was like, oh, it's the mark. Now it must be the mark because there's a chip involved. And I'm like, calm down. All of our alarmism does not help. We have to slow down and stop jumping to conclusions, especially when it comes to eschatology, because we've been wrong so many times. How many Christians have tried to say this is the day or the hour? And even just recently, within the last 3 years, we've had multiple figures try and say, oh, yep, here it is. You know, so I believe there are figures alive right now that are helping to create the infrastructure. Palantir, anybody? That is going to be utilized by the Antichrist. All the AI data centers. They already have been gathering information on us for a very long time. Snowden made that very clear when he blew the whistle. I mean, decades ago, he blew the whistle that our government was spying on us ever since 9/11. That was one of the big, you know, watershed moments in my life, that our government was not for us, that they were against us with the Patriot Act. They've been surveilling us, but they've been collecting so much information that they can't do anything with it. You'd have to hire thousands of analysts working tens of thousands of hours to sort through all of that material. But now that they have AI, AI can do what would take us years. It can do it in hours or minutes, right? And if you make it strong enough and you got a whole data center behind it to store the information and help sort it, oh man, Antichrist is not God. He will not be equal to God in any way, but he will be supernaturally empowered by Satan, in my opinion. But he will have the technology on this side of heaven in order to carry out his reign of destruction. So whoever he is, we have men that are actively helping to construct. The flock cameras have been talked about a few times in the chat here, and rightfully so. They're being used to spy on us now, but they will be used for more nefarious purposes. Right now, for big government, and then for big Antichrist government, they will be what is used. They pick the names they pick on purpose. Never forget that, man. Flock, Palantir. If anyone knows anything about Palantir lore and what they are in Lord of the Rings, like, these weirdos do this stuff on purpose to gaslight us. And then we get looked at, oh, you conspiracy theorists. And it's like, no, they're doing this. They show their hand on purpose for plausible deniability, you know, and so that they can chuckle at us and make us sound absurd. But even the term conspiracy theorists, those that know anything about it, know that that was a psyop as well. The CIA created that term to speak disparagingly of those who were asking questions. So, do I think he's alive now? Very possibly he could be here, but we have plenty of people. Peter Thiel just recently had a series of lectures on this particular topic. So was he talking about himself or one of his buddies? I don't know, but very much could have been.
That'd be a good swerve at the end of the lecture. By the way, I'm the guy.
Yeah, right. I'm setting all this stuff up for me, losers. I'm going to go to Venezuela. What South American country did he just go to? He just fled somewhere. Can you recall where it was that Peter Thiel just recently moved to?
No, I just know that guy has got his fingers in everything.
Yeah, he does. But he it's interesting because he just fled because he sees, you know, water's boiling here. So he ran for the hills. But he also ran outside of a certain blast radius because there's a particular little nation, a little sliver out there that has something called the Samson option. And I don't know how much you know about that, but
I know that it's nuclear.
Yes. It has limits on its range, and Peter Thiel moved just outside of that range. Isn't that funny? I think that's fascinating.
Boy, I hope it doesn't get to that point. I mean, knowing what's in the Book of Revelations, it certainly seems like that's a possibility when you read about things like wormwood and the killing of a third of sea life, although that might have just already happened throughout the years anyways, especially looking at the waters around the Pacific Northwest and the salmon runs and the whales and things like that, disappearance of coral reefs, the ocean's dying, period, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah. Pastor Nelly, what do you suppose the mark of the beast might be?
Ooh, well, Scripture does make one thing clear, that whoever doesn't have it will not be able to buy or sell. That we can say for sure. You will not be able to participate in commerce unless you take the mark. I don't think the mark is going to be something one will take by mistake. I remember the first time, maybe not the first time, but the first time I can recall in my lifetime of Christians hooting and hollering that the mark of the beast was when social security numbers were a thing. And then, you know, so birth certificates and social security numbers had something to do with the mark of the beast. Now, are they a means of tracking us? Oh, absolutely. Right. But are they the mark? No, I don't think the mark is going to be something that you take by accident. I think the way it's presented in Scripture scripture is that the mark of the beast is going to be a willful decision. You will have to make a decision to take the mark or not take the mark. And, you know, there's the passage that suggests, you know, either somewhere on the wrist or hand or somewhere on the forehead. I mean, the technology exists to do both. I mean, being up here in Washington and, you know, we got tech bros that put a chip in their hand and put the reader in their doorknob and only they can open their door. I mean, that technology exists now. Is that the mark? The guy that put a chip in his hand to open his front door? That's not the mark, right? But is that the technology that could be the mark? Maybe. I just know that it will limit what people can do. It will limit what people can do. And it will, because without being able to buy and sell, I mean, what does that mean? It means exactly what it says it means. Food and water, we still got to buy and sell food and water. So the things that are necessary for life require us to pay for. And if you ask these psychotech bros, they want us to pay for air. I mean, I've heard some of these weirdos chatting about they want to charge us for air. They want to charge us for intellect. I mean, they want to charge that if they could, they charge, you know, every person who did a single inquiry on ChatGPT, they'd love to charge you per question. You know what I mean? Like they want to eventually make everything something that they can profit off of. And whoever the Antichrist is and whatever that mark may be, you will have to profess allegiance to this entity by agreeing to take this mark. And that mark will be what allows you to participate in commerce. Those who refuse to take the mark will have difficulty participating in commerce, i.e. difficulty surviving. And regardless of one's views on the rapture and who will be here, whether it's only going to be new converts or whether or not, you know, existing Christians are going to be there, whoever's here is going to have a hard time and they're really going to have to pool together. But the target will be on anyone professing the name of Jesus. Again, regardless of your eschatological views, followers of Christ, whether you believe, will be here or not. There will be converts to Christianity during the tribulation, and they will be in severe hot water because to take the mark is to profess allegiance to. And I liken it to its kind of first century counterpart was when the cult of the emperor began to really emerge in the first century, where the Caesars wanted to start being deified. They're like, well, we got all these gods and that's great. And we're all going to worship all these gods, but you're going to worship me now too as a god. Right. And they set up all these little altars throughout the empire, and you do a little sprinkle of salt and you were supposed to say, you know, Kaiser Kyrios, you know, Caesar is Lord on this little altar. And that was it. To not participate in that act was to be barred from certain commerce. I mean, when you read through the seven letters to the seven churches throughout Asia Minor at the beginning of the book of Revelation, you notice that many of them, depending on how Romanized that area was, it wasn't just about rejecting the Greco-Roman pantheon. I mean, to not worship the Roman emperor in some of those places meant like you don't get to participate in commerce either. Like, hey, we're all going down to the local, you know, cult of the emperor temple. We're going to offer a sacrifice to him, and then we're going to have a barbecue, and then we're going to talk business about our you know, all of their guilds and things like that had patron gods and those kinds of things. But in any case, That's another reason why I can't say definitively if the Antichrist is here or not, because I believe all the infrastructure has been set up. I believe each time throughout history, each age has been convinced that there were a potential figure, or they were in that potential time. Imagine being in Europe during the 1940s and seeing things blowing up around you. I mean, how many Christians thought then that this must be the end? I mean, heck, we called it World War II. But the fact that we had a second one kind of hints that maybe it wasn't the end, and clearly it wasn't. But certain things did change irrevocably after that time. But the mark will... you know, I think we obsess over the digits associated with the mark. At the end of the day, it's the mechanics of it that I'm worried about, and that is it will prevent people from participating in commerce, i.e. participating in their own survival, and it will be a control mechanism that the Antichrist uses. He will be the ultimate big government. So that's what I believe about the mark specifically, which is I know a little vague, but I think anything beyond that gets into hot or... dangerous territory, speculative territory. Sure.
Yeah, there's also the fact that a mark on a beast in old times could refer to clipping the ears of a cattle to show that it's yours. And we know that we're being called goyim or cattle by certain elite groups. and there could be some crossover there. How about this whole idea of the graven image of the beast and having, how does it go? Life is breathed into the graven image and it begins to talk. Mm-hmm. That's part of Revelations, the false prophet and the beast. What do you suppose all that could be about? Maybe AI?
I think that robotics and AI are some really powerful candidates for some of that. Obviously, again, willing to be convinced otherwise, but I think right now in this present day and age, one of the greatest possibilities would be something AI empowered, robotic. They're creating all the things necessary for this grand deception. I think Project Bluebeam is a fascinating rabbit hole to go down to. Like, the deception will be very, very convincing. And when you see the robotics that are being popped out of China right now, it's terrifying that a lot of the stuff that's being made over there is very niche and very disgusting. But when you start to carry that stuff and bring up the production of it, I do think that the image may be empowered by AI, but maybe not. It might be something that's empowered by something else entirely. It might be something like a demonic possession of some kind. I mean, throughout ancient culture, whenever they prayed to idols, they knew that their god was not represented or was not inside of the wood or the stone that they were fashioning into their deity. But they would conduct, as far back as we can dig, they would have what's called opening of the mouth ceremonies, when they'd make an idol of their deity, and then they'd have a ceremony that would open its mouth. And when they opened its mouth, they believed that that entity was entering into the idol that they made, and that was their meeting point with said deity, right? And this was not foreign to ancient Israel either, because God represented his presence on earth via the Ark. The Ark of the Covenant was his throne, but he did model his presence off of that thing, or wherever it was. You were to believe that, okay, well, God is here too with us. If the gold box is here, God is here. And they even tried to manipulate him with that a few times and it backfired. But in any case, whether or not it's empowered by AI or they create something that can house, I believe ontologically that demons are not, all fallen angels are demonic. Not all demons are fallen angels. So I believe all fallen angels are demonic, but I don't believe all demons are fallen angels. I believe the demons, for example, the daimons that we see in the New Testament, these disembodied spirits, I believe them to be the disembodied spirits of the dead Nephilim that perished in the flood and have perished since. I believe those spirits seeking to be bodied again, to embody something. What if one of them, or many of them, if you say, well, why would many go into one? Legion? Ever read about Legion? And we see he's talked about where one man says, I am Legion, for we are many. So it could be this vessel, whether it's a statue or a robot of some kind that is either empowered by AI for deception, or these entities use it in the same way that they would demonically possess people in the Gospels, in the same way I believe demonic possession also take place today, though I think it largely takes place in other parts of the world. Not that it doesn't happen in the first world, but I believe Satan is using porn and lust and greed. He's got plenty of people with that. He doesn't need to be sending demons to take possession of everyone. But places that are involved more in the occult and things like that, I believe they're more prevalent in those areas. But could be one or many.
Los Angeles, yeah. Salem, New Orleans, places with that strong witchcraft culture.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the PNW specifically, like you said earlier, it's not this atheist place that a lot of people think it is. There actually is a lot of belief up here. It's just not Christian belief, but man, New Age is huge here. They are really open to the supernatural. That, by the way, that was another reason I created the show, was I wanted to awaken Christians to the reality of the supernatural and things like that. Like, I think certain hauntings and things like that, I believe them to be genuine events that took place. And I investigate them from a theological perspective, from a pastoral perspective. And there have been some that I I debunked. I don't like using that term, but that where I looked at the evidence and I said, look, I'm not convinced. You're free to disagree with me. But then I looked at other hauntings and I said, no, something's here. And I like to peel back the layers and say, oh man, especially like the story that The Exorcist was based off of. I mean, the little boy was really messing around with a Ouija board. That wasn't just in the movie. It was Reagan. It was a girl in the movie, but in real life, it was a boy. And that boy was also messing around with occult items. And I believe brought something into his life. And in certain hauntings, especially like the Conjuring house, man, I believe that was another thing that not to victim blame or shame, but I, some of it was amplified by turning to new age and occult practices. You know, in my
one
opinion.
Of the things I've always been really afraid of was dolls coming alive. And what is that? But one of these statues in a temple that's being possessed by a demon. In fact, if you look at some of the old Mesopotamian Sumerian stuff, like, you know, the Anunnaki, there's a point where they say that the temples were abandoned by the gods. Sorry. And from what I can tell, that it means that the statues stopped talking to them for some reason. Something was going on.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. Could be onto something, because those statues, they did matter. I mean, just like the Ark mattered. Remember the time the Philistines in 1 Samuel, they kidnapped the Ark? They defeated the Israelites because the Israelites were trying to use the Ark as a magic device. They were like, well, God, you have to make us win if we bring the Ark of the Covenant with us. And so they carried the Ark into battle, but God says, you're not going to twist my arm. He let them get their butts handed to them. And then the Philistines stole the Ark and they brought it back to the temple of Dagon. They set it in their temple and they wake up the next morning and their massive megalith to Dagon is on the ground, right? And they all are in awe. They stand it back up. But the next morning, not only is it down on the ground again, its head broke off and its hands broke off as well. And basically saying, like, Yahweh defeated Dagon in his own territory, and they were all spooked. They were like, get this thing the heck out of here. And they did. They sent it to another Philistine village. But from there, it began to create a plague everywhere that it went, until it went to all the major Philistine towns. And they're like, look, send it back to the Israelites. We don't want this thing anymore. and they eventually they did. Right. And so I definitely think, I think idols matter. I think our forefathers, you know, the people, ancient people were not dumb. They were not knuckle draggers, and the things that they were doing with these objects, there was a reason. I'd say there's even a reason that Israel was so deceived so many times. It's not because these other gods offered no power whatsoever. It's that, well, Yahweh won't give us the power we want when we want it, but Baal might, or Baal Hadad, or I mean, Baal, yeah, it means Lord generally, but it was assigned to a lot of other entities, right? And colloquially, we use it to speak of a singular entity. But in any case, I believe all of those are entities in rebellion. And many times they deceive the Jews. I'm of the belief also that their occult power is real. Not all of it. I think some of it is like sage magic. Obviously, that's sleight of hand. And I do believe that there are charlatans like the Long Island medium or somebody, you know, they read social cues and learn how to manipulate people's emotions. But I do believe, and I think the Bible is what convinced me of this, the occult and these entities, these fallen Elohim, they do offer power. They do. Because if you look at Janus and Jambres, Pharaoh's magicians, in Egypt, when Moses and Aaron are having their showdown with the Egyptians or with the gods of Egypt and with Pharaoh, they were able to duplicate those first few miracles. They were able to duplicate that. Now, eventually, they were unable to duplicate them any longer. And some say it's because their power was limited. And I agree with that in a different sense, though. I think at some point God shut the door and said, I'm not going to allow them to continue. I'm going to shut off the power because I control these beings. They're not more powerful than me. I'm going to shut them up so that you can't utilize their power anymore. But as I talk to more people who came out of the occult and I listen to their testimony, they're big on agreements, on contracts. Is not God big on contracts? That's what a covenant is. So that world is big on contracts. The spiritual world is big on contracts. Our God had contracts. He had covenants. Well, these beings do too. And I think they offer real power. And there are people that seek it. You talked about animating something and it made me think, sorry to take so long, but man, because I'm doing my Kabbalah deep dive, right? And I want to do an episode on the Golem. in Kabbalah, they're really big on words of power and things like that. And, you know, the right words having the right, you know, certain power and the, sure. especially the Golem of Prague, like put the a particular name on this lump of clay and it becomes sentient. Now in that case, like it did what they wanted for a while, and then eventually it turned on them. But that's always what happens, right? That's a, that when you flirt with those things, it always ultimately will backfire, will blow up in your face.
Yeah,
in the end.
I can tell you, Pastor Nelly, the reason why I'm such a devout Christian today is I was one of those people that was foolish enough to experiment with the occult and black magic.
Oh wow!
And it got to the point where I was being gang stalked by possessed people on, it was on social media, and they were doing it in front of, you know, totally innocent people, which was just mind blowing. I was seeing things. I was, I had the ability to know what others were thinking. And, there were a lot of little supernatural things that were developing. I was even starting to crave the taste of blood, where I was like craving it. Seriously.
Wow.
And I even had one of these, what kind of brought it to a close was one of these entities requested that I make a sacrifice. And you know, I would never kill anything ever. Bugs, mice, cats, especially a person, I would never ever do that. And that's what got me thinking that I was messing around with some seriously dark forces. But through prayer, through strong prayer, it ended it instantly.
Wow.
So that's my testament to the power of the true living God, is he brought an end to this torturous demonic experience that I was having. And I could not be a more devout Christian today. Christianity is the truth, period.
Amen. That's so powerful. I didn't know that about you. That's incredible. And I'd love, I've never had any guests on my show really, but I'd love to hear your story and share that with my audience too. Maybe one day we'll iron out the details for that, because I personally would love to hear that journey. And I think there's a lot of people in my audience that would love to hear it too.
I would love to go on your show and give my complete testimony, starting at childhood. I was somebody that was raised with Christianity, but like you, I rebelled against it intensely. I felt like it was being forced upon me. And then, you know, to rediscover it. That's why I love the story of the prodigal son. I believe that's what that story is alluding to. You know, the Christians who, you know, for whatever reason, they're pushed away from the faith, perhaps by outside forces, and they find their way back. I think that's a very powerful thing. And yeah. that really cements one's belief in one's faith, which is really what it's all about, is the power and the strength of your faith. You know, with it, we can move mountains. But Pastor Nelly, man, this has been a great interview.
Thanks.
You exceeded all expectations.
Praise the
Lord. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely a great guest. I'll definitely be checking out your podcast. And definitely, you know, if you want me to go on there, I would absolutely love to.
Awesome.
But yeah. Before we end things today, I want to, you know, first of all, tell everybody to check out your podcast, The Dancing Toaster. But why don't you go ahead and hop up on the podium one more time, hop up on the soapbox and just say whatever you'd like to say to my audience out there, and feel free to, you know, plug or promote anything that you'd like to plug or promote. The floor is yours.
Thank you. First, Daniel, just thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I've been mutually blessed by this. It's been a really exciting conversation, and I love the freedom at which you've allowed me to speak and share some of my views and experiences and thoughts on certain things. So, yeah, the Dancing Toaster podcast is what it's called. It's on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, although stuff on YouTube is delayed and up because I have to, it's an audio based show right now. I don't have video, but I am working on that. I first had to upgrade hardware, and now I'm working on I'm trying to learn certain things, because I know I have an audio background because of music, not video. So I'm still learning some things and want to upgrade eventually. But yeah, I mean, we're almost 60 episodes in. I have more than 60 episodes because I had the two shows for a while, Man Eating Toaster, The Dancing Toaster. I cover the paranormal, supernatural. I cover cults and bizarre true crime. But lately I've been talking a lot about the occult and kind of the history of it. And because when I read the Epstein files, I found out a lot of really evil, powerful people, they don't think this stuff is silly. They don't. They believe in it wholeheartedly, and they are participating in things that would shock all of us, or should shock all of us. They shocked me, and I been talking about those things a lot, but anywhere podcasts are found, you can find the Dancing Toaster. It is an audio format, and I am trying to upgrade that. I'm really big on storytelling. I think stories are powerful. They allow us to carry messages in interesting ways. So I try to present the stories in a very entertaining way, even some of the darker ones. Some have accused me of being a horror podcast. That's not the intent, although stories about demonic possession are terrifying because, well, it's real. It has happened. It continues to happen far more than I think we realize. So I got a lot of episodes on that. Check out the back catalog. Please forgive me for the things that maybe I said in earlier episodes that maybe I wouldn't co-sign today. I thought about going back and deleting certain episodes or altering certain episodes, but I said, no, I'm not going to do that because I think the growth has been important. I think people seeing someone's mind changed over time is important in a time where the world is, everyone goes on a social media to change somebody else's mind, not to have their mind changed. And my listeners and my audience and those that I've been able to fellowship with, like you, Daniel, have helped me grow and tighten up on some areas and loosen up on some other areas and really put Christ to the forefront. So I'm fascinated by these topics. I talk about all kind of manner of things. I do have a Patreon. I am a pastor and a podcaster. That's what I do up here. And that's what I've been doing for a pastor almost 20 years now. Senior pastor, only about six. And I love the Word of God. I love people. The show is not perfect. Neither am I, but it's a lot of fun. I'd love for you to check it out. And if you want to support the work that I'm doing, if you do like it, head on over to the Patreon. And if you like, and I got some of my Dancing Toaster drip here. Here's the Loch Ness shirt here. I got an episode on Loch Ness. That was one of my first cryptids I ever learned about when I was a kid checking out a book from the library. But I got an episode on that. Got a lot of fun stuff on the Dancing Toaster store.printful.me. Lots of hats, bags, shirts, and all kinds of cool stuff to rep the show if you do enjoy it, or if you just enjoy my funny, goofy little mascot.
Well, hey, you know, that's funny because I love cryptids and cryptozoology, and we did not talk about it at all. So we're going to have to do some kind of sequel or part
two. Let's do it. You got it. You say when. I'll be here, man. I've had such a great time, and you're a wonderful brother. And I mean, we only met like 15 minutes before the show, but I'm grateful you found me. I gotta tell my boys at the Dangerous Info podcast that they heard about me from them and thank them for having me on so many times. And thank you for having me on, Daniel. I want to do it again, and I'd love for, you know, to, if you, maybe you can even help me work out the logistics of having you on my show too, because right now it is a one-man operation. I'd have to start by buying a second mic or no, I'd have to get the software that you're doing here. So who knows?
Yeah, we'll figure it out. Sure. Yeah. It's really easy. I can guide you through it. It's
awesome.
It's just it's a very easy thing to do, and I'd love to help you get set up. I'd love to appear as well. But once again, thank you so much, Pastor Nelly. It has been fascinating. I absolutely do want to talk to you again. And, you know, it is funny the way that I encountered you and the way that we ended up doing the show, but it just shows that God is good. He's bringing us like-minded people together in the right times. And definitely thank you so much. And I will talk to you again, my friend. But until then, have a very good night and happy belated 4th of July.
Likewise. Thank you, dear brother.
All right. That was Pastor Nelly Van Sickle, specifically from the Dancing Toaster podcast, which we learned was actually inspired by the Ghostbusters movies. I think that is fascinating in itself. And I'd definitely like to get more into that with him because, my God, that was a phenomenal guest. You know, it's rare that somebody that I know somebody's going to be good and they're even better, but I love talking about the Bible. I love talking about Revelations, and I love the positive direction that this show is headed down. I think that, you know, since coming back from my long hiatus, I feel like the show is better than ever, and I appreciate you guys coming back. I appreciate you guys still being here and keeping me in mind. You know, there probably are. Kilburn says that was an informative show. Definitely, definitely. I myself learned something incredible. And, you know, I'm kind of talking about that bit where we were talking about the Book of Enoch. But, you know, we went a good over 2 hours here. So I'm not gonna talk about the news or anything like that. I think we got the good information out there. So I'm going to go ahead and bring things to a close. Once again, thank you all for joining me. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to support the show, of course, go to endofdaysradio.com. You can click the donate. This show doesn't really make any money. It's a passion project, but those donations do help quite a bit. Help keep the servers on, help keep the lights on, definitely help me facilitate doing this show. So thank you so much. Endofdaysradio.com, click donate. You can now donate through Cash App. So if you were somebody that didn't like using PayPal or Bitcoin, and you now have that third option. And I know there's some other ones too. I'm exploring those. I just want to make sure that if you do want to donate, you are able to do that. Other than that, the show should be back once a week from now on. You can actually have YouTube send you a push notification or something like that when the show is on. The problem is that we do the show at different times every week. And that has to do with my work schedule. And that also has to do with the guests. We might have somebody that's located in the UK or somebody that's actually located in, you know, a real faraway place like the Middle East, something like that. And in my time, when it's morning for me, it's like 11 p.m. for them. So that's when I have to do like an early Sunday show. And I'm willing to do that because, you know, if the guest is worth it and worth listening to, I'm willing to wake up early and do the show at a totally different time. So the show is always going to be on at different times. The nice thing is you can go anywhere that has podcasts, as well as YouTube, Rumble, BitChute, iHeartRadio. I believe our biggest platform is actually Spotify. So, you know, you'd think it would be Apple Podcasts or it would be YouTube, but it seems like we get most listens on Spotify. I believe Spotify is the main way that most people listen to podcasts and music nowadays. So I guess, you know, it is what it is. We don't have any exclusive contract with them, but you can definitely listen on Spotify. And you can listen to a 24/7 stream of the show on Spotify as well, or the TuneIn Radio app. You can listen on, you just go to the End of Days Radio website. And I'm going to be working on the website a bit more. I have some ideas for articles and things like that I'm going to be adding. So we'll be getting more content on there and actually give you guys a reason to visit the website instead of me just constantly telling you guys to go there for pretty much no reason other than to get the show, which you're probably getting through some other means. But thank you once again. Pardon my allergies today. I'm a little bit of a bubble boy. And I've been having to hop off camera and mute myself quite a bit because I'm sneezing constantly. It's part of being a bubble kid in a world full of pollen. So I apologize for that. Hopefully I'm not having that issue next week. But maybe I'll grab some Benadryl or something a little bit safer. Until then, this is Daniel. I am ending the signal here in the Broken Ruins in the Pacific Northwest. I am signing off, guys. Thank you again so much, and I will see you next week. We got a lot of great shows planned. I'll see you then. Turn that radio on. Have you seen the signs?
broken ruins of Babylon, calling out my name, rust on the tower stairs, ash on every room, late at night the signal cuts like a tongue unstrung. Bigfoot in the tree line, wolves at the gate, vampires on the highway, talking about my fate. Daniel in the dust to look up and stand. Jesus at the window with fire in his hand. Circles in the mud, rusty old radio station, breathing out that blood. Bigfoot by the tower, footprints in the clay. Every lie I ever trusted, falling away. Broken bells are ringing.
Burn it down to nothing.